Good morning to you. Thanks for letting me come back. I know that last week was a little intense, and today will be less so, but no less important. We're going to be in Genesis chapter 32. If you've got a Bible, please turn to Genesis 32. Today we're going to talk about Jim Bridger, of all people, and Jacob, and the end of self-sufficiency. And we're going to see Jesus in all of this, because the series that we're wrapping up today is about showing and seeing Jesus in the Old Testament. And so we're going to see Jesus today in a very odd encounter with one of the patriarchs, Jacob. But I also want to talk about Jim Bridger. I have some fascination and interest in the explorers, the mountain men that kind of roamed this region. I'm talking about Jim Bridger today because, well, I'm in Bozeman. So Jim Bridger, as you know, is everywhere. There's Fort Bridger, and there's the Bridger Mountains, and the Bridger Wilderness, and Bridger Bowl, and Bridger Trail Run, and Bridger Creek Golf Course, and there's a few schools named after Bridger, and there's dozens of entities in Bozeman with the name Bridger in there, perhaps most notably Bridger Brewing. For those of you who eschew a Coors Light. I think there's a lot of dogs named Bridger as well in Bozeman. But you could find a lot worse people to name something or someone after. But it was a rocky start for the grand old man of the Rockies, as he's been called. I'm indebted to the historical research of a couple of authors, John Walton and Grace Hebert, as I've learned much about Jim Bridger. He was born in 1804, an explorer, mountain man, trapper, scout, guide. He was a part of the second generation of explorers that came in through this region behind Lewis and Clark. He was one of the first to see the geysers of Yellowstone. He was the first outsider to see the Great Salt Lake in Utah. He's the guy who pioneered the Bridger Pass, which went from central Wyoming and shortened the Oregon Trail by 61 miles, not insignificant. And then there's the Bridger Trail that's named after him, and that's because he found a way from Wyoming into the gold fields of Virginia City. Bridger was savvy and wise, and nobody knew the Rocky Mountains like Jim Bridger. The railroads relied on him heavily to get through the Rocky Mountains. He was 6 foot tall, thin and wiry, surprisingly strong. He was also quiet and humble and dependable. One of his friends says this about him: he was the one man of the time that I never heard anything but good spoken of. To me, the simplicity, gentleness, and kindliness and absolute truthfulness of his character marked him as a man above the common. And you know, we should all aspire to that, to have people speak that way of our lives and our character. Where John Coulter was first into the region, Jim Bridger was revered in the region. And he was the grand old man of the Rockies, but got off to a rocky start. And the rocky start was an event that's now made horribly famous in the movie The Revenant. So, show of hands if you've seen The Revenant, please. Okay, so for a bunch of you, I'm going to ruin but you've had a decade, you know, it's been out for long enough. I'm going to ruin part of it for you. So I need you to know that when my friends saw The Revenant, they would come to me and say, "Don't see The Revenant." And I'd be like, "What?" They're like, "Don't see The Revenant." And the reason they're saying this to me is because I have an irrational fear of grizzly bears. And so there's this grizzly bear attack that is historic, and they do a pretty good job of showing how terrible it is in The Revenant. And so my friends were like, "You just don't want to see it." But I'm doing research on Jim Bridger, so of course I see it. And it's as horrific as I expected it to be. However, the written descriptions of the attack are worse. But I have some history with grizzly bears. Well, first, okay, credibility dump right now. I'm a grizz. Okay, so let's just cover that. Okay. I got one brother back there somewhere. You're standing strong. It's not my fault. My dad graduated from the U. I went there for a couple years. Then Jesus took me back and I transferred. So you can use that how you want, but I didn't transfer here. It was a different school. But I've only drawn my weapon once in the backcountry. Was bow hunting and came around a grove of trees, and about 30 yards was a grizz rooting around. And I saw that grizz before that grizz saw me. And so I drew my weapon, but slowly backed away. And then my buddy's behind me, and he's from out of state, so he didn't know what was going on. And I said, get your bear spray out, get your bear spray out. And so he's, you know, trying to find his bear spray and not spray himself, you know. And then I'm just kind of tracking this grizz, and he wins us, and so he just starts to move away. But I'm going with him, and my buddy's right next to me. And I'm going with him, and he's really, really bright. He's a very smart person. And he leans into my ear and goes, "Why are we pursuing him?" I was like, "That's actually a good question." I said, "Because I want to see where he goes so he doesn't come back and eat you." "Oh, okay." So, my horse once was in the backcountry, and there was this tremendous commotion while I was trying to sleep. And it was out happening where my horse is on a high line. And so I come flying out of the tent with headlamp on and guns, headlamp blazing, but guns not. But, you know, and I go right over to my horse, and he's torn down the high line, but he's just standing there with these big old eyes, and he's looking at me like, "Did you see that? Because that was scary." And I was like, "I didn't see it, and I'm sorry, buddy," you know, and I get him all calmed down and put back to bed. But I'm telling you, that was a grizz. I don't know how, but I just feel like that was a grizz. But that's my irrational fear about it. One time I was in the thoroughfare, the highest concentration of grizzly bears in the lower 48. And I was in there for a few days and never saw a grizz, which was God's favor on me, because Fish and Game flew it while I was in there. I watched their plane go right over my head. And they were counting grizzlies because of the cut-wing moths were hatching, and that's a delicacy for them. So it turns out there was 55 grizzly bears that they counted. I didn't see one of them, which is Jesus going, "He's such a wimp. Let's just give him a break, you know." But then I took the bear aware class that Tactic puts on, and that was really, really helpful, because then that's where I met Adam. So some of you know about Adam. This is a old grizzly bear who's kind of a movie bear, and the Tactic class, we go hang out with this bear, and I fed this grizzly bear a donut from my mouth. It was very therapeutic for me. But then there was a couple of things. Like, I was standing there, handlers talking about him, and all of a sudden, Adam, this grizzly bear, starts coming towards me, and I'm just like, I'm okay with it, you know, because, I mean, I fed him a donut, and he's coming, and then the handler goes, ah, and he sticks a stick in front of him and goes, no, knock it off. And I was like, "What did you do wrong?" He goes, "You got any food in your pocket?" I was like, "Well, yeah, like three layers deep. I've got a small granola bar and a, you know, wrapped in its package." He goes, "Yeah, he was coming for that granola bar." I was like, "Oh, no." I mean, that knows, right? Then he tells us this story. He was on a movie set, and he comes across two guys that have got a crowbar, big iron bar, and a fulcrum underneath it, and they've got it underneath a boulder, and they're leaning on the other end, pushing down, trying to lift this boulder up. And the handler comes up to him and goes, "What are you guys doing?" They go, "We want to see how good Adam's nose really is." And so the three of them get this boulder up. They take three M&Ms, not packages, not three like sheet cakes, three M&Ms, stick it under that boulder, lower it back down. Handler goes and gets Adam, brings him out. Adam sniffs the front of the boulder, walks around it 360, sniffing and sniffing, comes back around to the front, left paw, sticks it under, lifts it up, right? Three guys, crowbar, Adam, left paw, yep, looks under there, takes his claw and scrapes those three M&Ms out, sets it down and eats them. And when he told me that story, I was like, why am I hanging my food in the backcountry? That is so stupid. Because you know that I've got granola bar residue in a pocket of my pack or my pants or something. And if the bear's like coming in, he's coming in. Like, I can smell that granola bar. So it seems better to me to just, I don't know, wrap yourself in bacon and go to bed. No more hanging food. Doesn't make sense. Okay, so these are some reasons to be afraid of the grizzly bear. Which then brings us to the Hugh Glass ordeal. August 1823, Jim Bridger's employed by a fur trader, as is mountain man Hugh Glass. A couple of months earlier, 15 of their men of their party were killed by Arikara warriors on the Missouri. There's danger everywhere. Hugh Glass is out hunting, which is what he was employed to do, and he gets between a sow and her two cubs. The attack is ruthless. They do a pretty good CG job of it in the movie. The written descriptions are horrifying. Hugh Glass survives this attack somehow, but the party needs to move on, and so two guys volunteer to stay back. A guy by the name of John Fitzgerald, who is older than Jim Bridger II. And their job was to wait with Hugh Glass for him to die and then bury him. Well, 5 days later, Hugh Glass is still alive, and these two guys, Fitzgerald and Bridger, are feeling more and more vulnerable, fearing another attack. Some accounts say there was another attack. At any rate, they make the decision to abandon Hugh Glass. And they didn't just leave him, you know, for dead. They took his gun, his ammunition, his knife, his tomahawk, and his fire starter. So he's got nothing. They reunite with their party and then lie. They say that Glass has died, he has expired, and he's been buried. Now, Hugh Glass was a tough guy. Hugh Glass was a tough guy, and he started to recover, and he gained his strength, and spurred by revenge and the desire to get his stuff back, he walked 250 miles to Fort Kiowa, that's in South Dakota, and he's looking for Fitzgerald and Bridger, and they're not there. So he moves on in winter to Fort Henry, which is east of Billings on the Bighorn River, and on January 1st, he stumbles into Fort Henry, and he confronts the very petrified 19-year-old Jim Bridger. And now from the historians. Glass leaned upon his rifle. His thoughts took a sudden turn. The more guilty object of his revenge had escaped. That's Fitzgerald. The pitiful being before him, Bridger, was perhaps but the unwilling and persuaded accomplice of his much older companion. Glass said to the boy, "You have nothing to fear for me. Go. You are free for your youth. I forgive you." One other historical account says that Glass says this, "Go, my boy, I leave you to the punishment of your own conscience and your God. If they forgive you, then be happy." Now, what was that like for Jim Bridger? All of that guilt and all of that fear contradicted by forgiveness. And it makes me wonder if that moment, that forgiveness, is what set the tone for the rest of Jim Bridger's life such that he would grow and mature into the grand old man of the Rockies. And it also reminds me of a very famous and rather weird encounter in the Bible. Finally, we are getting there. It's Jacob in Genesis 32, where Hugh Glass wrestled with the Grizz and where Jim Bridger wrestled what to do with a dying man in a desperate situation. It's Jacob who wrestles with God. By way of quick primer, reminder for some of you, Jacob and Esau, they are twins. Esau is born first. Jacob comes out second, but he's gripping the heel of Esau, which gives him his name, Jacob, which means one who grabs the heel, but it figuratively means that he is a deceiver, which he is. He steals the birthright from his older brother, which means that he's now going to get the double inheritance from his dad. Then he, while his dad is dying, takes advantage of him and steals the blessing from his dad. He manipulates that process as well. And so 27:41, you don't have to turn there. Let me just show you this one. For it says this, Esau held a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing his father had given him. And he said to himself, "The days of mourning for my father are near. Then I will kill my brother Jacob." Meaning, my dad is going to die. And then when he dies, we have this sequence of time for mourning. When that's all done, I'm going to kill him. So Jacob figures this out and he escapes. He moves to a totally different territory, lives with a relative. He gets married a couple of times. He has a family. It grows. He works. He prospers. He's there for 20 years. He's a good businessman. He's building his own enterprise. He needs to separate from his uncle because of some odd family dynamics. And he leaves and ends up in the territory of, you guessed it, Esau. Esau, who he hasn't seen for 20 years, and he hasn't seen Esau for 20 years for good reason, because Esau wants to kill him. And so he sends messengers to Esau asking for favor, essentially saying to Esau, please don't kill me. The messengers come back with, well, Esau's coming and he's bringing hell with him, 400 of his warriors. So Jacob remembers that his brother wants to kill him, of course. So he prays, and then he divides his family into two groups, literally thinking, because the guy's a weasel, he's literally thinking, well, Esau and those guys are going to kill my family, but if I can separate them, maybe they'll just kill half my family. So he separates them, and the other half might get away. That's his plan. He then assembles a bunch of gifts, prays a bunch more, develops a plan to give the gifts in three waves, and it's opulent, all the gifts, all this livestock that he's going to give to his brothers, and he's doing it to his brother, and he's doing it to pacify him. And he tells his servants to give instructions that as they're giving the gift to Esau to say, this is a gift from Jacob. And then that night, Jacob has his family and his servants cross over the river Jabbok. And then Jacob is left alone. He stays at the river. He moves everybody on. He's just kind of this manipulative, deceiving, usurping wussy, and he's staying at the river, and he's alone, and it's night, and here comes the grizz. And Jacob gets attacked, not by a grizz, but by God. And here's the account, verse 24. So Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. When the man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip so that his hip was wrenched or dislocated as he wrestled with the man. Then the man said, let me go, for it is daybreak. But Jacob replied, I will not let you go unless you bless me. So the man asked him, what's your name? Jacob. Weasel. Usurper. Deceiver. Then the man said, well, your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, which means one who struggles with God, or colloquially, God wrestler, because you have struggled with God and with men and have overcome. And Jacob said, please tell me your name. But he replied, why do you ask me my name? And then he blessed him. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, is because I saw God face to face. Peniel means the face of God. Is because I saw God face to face, and yet my life was spared. When the sun rose above him as he passed Peniel, he was limping because of his hip. One rabbi says this is one of the most mysterious stories in all of the Bible. Jacob is wrestling with God himself, and Jacob is winning. The prophet Hosea implies that Jacob is actually wrestling with Jesus. So in theology, we have a couple of technical terms that you don't need to remember, but I'm going to talk about them. The first one is theophany. Theos, God. Theophany. A theophany is when you're reading in the Old Testament, you see a manifestation of God that is tangible to the human senses. The burning bush for Moses, theophany. The pillar cloud, theophany. When God visits Abraham, theophany. Under theophany is another term that's descriptive. It's Christophany. You can figure that one out. Christ as in Christ. Christophany is a manifestation of the second person of the Trinity, Jesus, tangible to the human senses. So this is God as second person of the Trinity, pre-Bethlehem event, okay, pre-birth from Mary, showing up in a scenario. In this scenario, Jacob is wrestling with Jesus, and there's going all night. And Jacob is winning, and Jesus cheats, which I think he's entitled to. You're the creator, but, you know, did you read it? He cheats. Like, he's struggling with Jacob, and he reaches out and touches his hip and dislocates it, which you can't do, and neither can I, but Jesus can. But at any rate, that's his method, so it works in the octagon, and so he dislocates his hip. Jacob, remember, he's hanging on to his brother's heel coming out of the womb? Well, now he's hanging on to Jesus' heel, and Jesus is saying, I got to go. And Jacob goes, well, you got to bless me. And then he goes, well, I'll bless you, but I'm going to change your name from Weasel to God Wrestler, because you've wrestled with God today. And then he gives him a blessing. And then in the morning, Jacob is limping, and he's limping so that Jacob knows that it wasn't a dream. It actually really, really happened. Not to mention that limp that he probably has for the rest of his life is going to remind him of what we think is his conversion experience as he was wrestling with God that night. And then he looks up, and he sees Esau and hell with him, 400 guys. And then an interesting thing happens. The plans change. Instead of waiting behind the waves of gifts, remember the three waves of gifts? Jacob, who's been changed now, he's wrestled with God, had an encounter with God, and has been changed by God. He leads the way now, and he limps out to Esau. Where Jacob had been living on his self-sufficiency and shaking in his fear, he is now limping on his humility. And here's what he does, verse 3 of 33. He himself went on ahead and bowed down to the ground 7 times as he approached his brother. When you bow before a king, you would do it 7 times. What's what he's doing right now? He's like, Esau, you're king, and I'm your servant. Verse 4, but Esau ran to meet Jacob and embraced him, threw his arms around his neck and kissed him, and they wept. Because Esau forgave Jacob. Jacob, the favorite of their mother, Jacob, who laid on pillows around the tents, while his brother, who the Bible calls a man of the open country, so he wears Sitka, is out in the open country, optifade, and old Jacob, you know, he's just kind of soft, and the favorite of his mother, and he's sort of babied, and then he manipulates and gets the birthright, and then he steals the blessing, and then he overcomes obstacles and becomes successful and wealthy. And Esau's had a hard life, and he comes and embraces, and he hugs the neck, and he kisses the cheek, and he weeps his forgiveness. Jim Bridger screwed up, and he was petrified of meeting Hugh Glass. But the tracker tracked and trapped the trapper at Fort Henry, and surprisingly, Hugh Glass forgave him. I submit to you that forgiveness is the kind of thing that would shape a young man to become the old man of the Rockies. Because forgiveness is a game changer. It is a life changer, and Jacob got it from Esau, and it changed his life. And Jim Bridger got it from Hugh Glass, and it saved his life. It changed his life. It shaped his life. And if you put yourself in Esau's sandals for a minute, think for just a moment about, I mean, we're talking about Jacob, but Esau forgave his brother, and his brother did a bunch of bad things. So how's that going for you on forgiving others and the things that people have done against you? Those who have stole your birthright, stole your blessing, stole your dignity, stole your rifle, your ammunition, your fire starter, someone who has left you for dead. And the best thing you can do for you is to forgive them. It's the healthiest thing you could do. And if you got to wrestle with God in the process, then do it. But then dig deep and grit and forgive them. But let's flip it a little bit. Have you ever apologized to someone and had them not accept your apology? Have you ever even taken it further and more biblically obedient and asked them for forgiveness because you sinned against them and they said no? Or worse, they said, I forgive you, but they didn't? Because you can tell by the way they treat you and what they say about you and how they promise when you forgive somebody that you're not going to use it against you or use it against them ever again, and that's what they're doing to you. They said, yeah, I forgive you, but they're using it against you. That is so hurtful. And I know what it feels like. I've had people withhold forgiveness from me. I've had people that I've apologized to multiple times, and they would even say, like, I forgive you, or I forgave you a long time ago, and yet their behavior betrays that in the way that they treat me or talk about me, slander me, or use it against me over and over again. They haven't forgiven me. And that is a terrible feeling, but it's interesting because especially over the last year for me, what that has done for me, forgiveness being withheld, is it has made me that much more grateful for God's forgiveness for me. You follow me there? Matter of fact, I have this little mantra that I say now. This is very subjective, but I say, like, God, the greatest thing about God is his forgiveness. The coolest thing, the best thing about God is that he forgives people. I love that about God. I need that from him. And so when I have somebody withhold forgiveness from me, I'm like, well, they don't forgive me, but Jesus does. And I didn't arrest them, spit on them, flog them, nail them to a cross, run a spear through their side, but my sin did that to Jesus, and he forgives me. So I'm going with Jesus on this. I'm going to live in forgiveness even though somebody else is holding forgiveness against me. And this happens to me a lot where, does this ever happen to you that you, maybe you're doing something that, where you can just kind of turn your brain off, you know, like maybe you're watching a Bobcat game or something and I wasn't going to do that. I'm sorry. Yeah, thanks for forgiving me. Thank you. God, just credibility drop again and I apologize. It wasn't necessary. Mowing the lawn there. So you're mowing the lawn, and do you ever think of something, it just comes whipping into your head, something dumb that you did, a sin that you committed, something where you wronged somebody, you're even embarrassed about it. Am I the only one? Okay, this thing happens to you. And so what happens to me now, and it's just my ritual, because there's a lot of these, and I'll think of it and go, oh, and then I tell the Lord, I'm sorry about that. And then I say, will you forgive me? And then I follow it up with, thanks for your forgiveness. I mean, it's just so life-giving. I'm like, I can't believe you forgive me. Thank you. Forgiveness is just the best. And getting it requires some humility on our parts and dependence and a reliance on somebody else because you're giving them some power when you ask them for forgiveness. And that really means that this is the death of self-sufficiency. See, as Christians, we mess up when we get forgiveness and we give forgiveness and we humbly rely on somebody other than ourselves. Being a Christian is the end of self-sufficiency. So in my last few minutes here, I want to talk a little bit about self-sufficiency because if the mountain men and the explorers were anything, they were self-sufficient and so was Jacob. Jacob was manipulative and deceptive, but those are just symptoms of a deeper character flaw, and that's something that I think we all struggle with to some degree, and that is the issue of self-sufficiency. So just so we know what we're talking about, self-sufficient means needing no outside help and satisfying one's basic needs. That's what I'm talking about. Now, hold on. We like self-sufficiency because it's good, because nations and governments and businesses and communities and churches and families run better when everybody takes responsibility and they don't expect to be weighted on hand and foot with an air of an entitlement and laziness. Everything runs better when people have some self-sufficiency in them. And the explorers and the mountain men, they were self-sufficient. They had to be. John Coulter's pack was 30 pounds, and he said it was enough for several months. Isn't that hilarious? 30 pounds, enough for several months. I'm going to take my Yellowstone Theological Institute students next week on a backpack trip in Yellowstone National Park as part of a practicum that they do. And I bet my pack is at least 50 pounds for 3 days. Because, you know, I want all my stuff. These guys have 30 pounds for several months. That's self-sufficiency. It's a good quality, but only so far and only in submission to an ultimate authority. Self-sufficiency only works in the long run in humility and dependence on the rightful awareness of God's presence in our journey, where we are accountable to God and dependent on God. So your work ethic, your independence, your pull yourself up by your bootstraps mentality, your leave me alone, your let me live my life in peace mentality, you know this, it can be prideful and ignorant, because self-sufficiency is an illusion for anybody that wants to live a full life. I mean, you can live in a cabin in Lincoln and send bombs in the mail, you can, but that's not a full life. And it keeps people from God. It keeps Christians from living lives of faith and humility and giving God proper credit for their success. Self-sufficiency actually leads to pride, and we all know that pride leads to a fall. We see it all the time. And so maybe you need some time on the Jabbok River wrestling. You know how we use that sometimes as a colloquialism in Christianity? We say, you know, I'm really wrestling with God right now. Roll. Do that. Apparently, God likes to wrestle, so he wants to wrestle with you. He might cheat. It might hurt a little bit, but that limp is just going to be part of you understanding who you are and who God is, and you relying on his grace and sufficiency for your life, so you're not self-sufficient, you're relying on him. Jesus attacks Jacob on the banks of the Jabbok River, and Jacob's self-sufficiency was crumbling. He's afraid. He can't protect his family. He might lose it all. Esau's hell-bent on revenge. He's bringing 400 warriors with him. He's been manipulating and scheming his whole life, and it caught up to him right there on the Jabbok River. And he wrestled with God, and God won, and that was victory for Jacob. Because where he was once living on fear, now he's limping on humility, and it's humility that made the way for the forgiveness that he did not deserve. And so he then finally released control and stopped manipulating and stopped deceiving and laid himself bare and put himself before the mercy of another, the mercy of God, and he laid down his self-sufficiency. Awesome. J.I. Packer is an author and scholar. Really good summary, so I'm reading the whole thing. Here it is on the screen. Jacob grew ever more conscious of his own state, utterly helpless and without God, utterly hopeless. He felt the full bitterness of his unscrupulous, cynical ways now coming home to roost. He'd been self-reliant, believing himself to be more than a match for anything that might come, but now he felt his complete inability to handle things and knew with blinding, blazing certainty that never again dare he trust himself to look after himself and to carve out his own destiny. Never again dare he try to live by his wits. We should not try to live by our wits. We are too fallible and too foolish. We will screw this up. And Hugh Glass is coming. Young Jim Bridger at Fort Henry, that was his Jabbok River. And the word was out that Hugh Glass is alive, and in he walks on that cold January day, and he's looking for Bridger, and the scars are still red on his face, and Bridger goes white as the snow that's coming through the open door, because it's freaking Hugh Glass. He once was dead, he's now alive. I'm dead. Many who reject Jesus do so because they simply think they don't need him. Successful and tough, I don't need him. Self-sufficient, deny sin, I can get better on my own. I can change at any time. I'm the master of my own destiny. I'm good. I've got faith in myself, my instincts, my skills. Don't need God. But something you need to know about God is that he is just too loving. He likes you just too much to let that continue. He wants you to live a life that's full and free and forgiven. And so what does it take then for a person to actually consider God? Sometimes it takes crisis and tragedy and obstacle and things are out of control. Attacked by Jesus at the River Jabbok, Hugh Glass walks into the room. But you don't have to wait till then. You just make a decision to humbly drop your self-sufficiency and turn to your Creator who loves you and will be holding you accountable one of these days. You know, not even Jesus was self-sufficient. Matthew 5, Jesus says over a few times, like, I can't do anything by myself. I only do what pleases God. I can't do anything without my Father. I do what he tells me to do. Jesus would never have gone to the cross if he was self-sufficient. He was doing that out of submission, driven by a love for us, not a love for himself. And so Jim Bridger got old. He suffered from goiter and rheumatoid arthritis, and he went blind, and he died at the age of 77. It's the same thing that's going to happen to all of us. And come on now, it's the end of self-sufficiency when you die. Turns out you weren't that sufficient after all. But Jacob fought with God and lost. And he got humbled and poured out and emptied and no longer self-sufficient, and that's his victory. Where he finally goes, I need God and I need his blessing and I need his forgiveness. In that moment, the very best thing about God for Jacob was forgiveness. That'll change a man, that'll change a woman, from Jacob to Israel, from deliverer or deceiver to wrestler, from cocky to humble, from the farce of self-sufficiency, like the myth of self-sufficiency, to the courage of actually being dependent on God. Change somebody from the boy who abandoned Hugh Glass to the grand old man of the Rockies. So may you wrestle with the Grizz. May you wrestle with God and survive it. And while wrestling, put to death your self-sufficiency, which will then allow you to thrive on the very best thing about God, forgiveness. Would you take a moment to pray, please? And I would like you to just speak to God about some of the things that you're thinking about as we went through his scripture today and talked about some of God's qualities and character, and what might you need to say to God now. And maybe you haven't ever experienced forgiveness from God or talked about that with him, so you could just tell him, really, I'm sorry. And will you forgive me? And what you're apologizing for is sin, wrongdoing. Nobody's hurt your happiness more than you. The hurt that you've caused yourself and others, just sorry. Please forgive me. And then receive his forgiveness with gratitude. Say thank you. Thank you for your forgiveness. I need it. Jesus, we know that it came at an incredible cost, so we respect that. Thank you for the suffering that you went through on our behalf, so that we could live a life of forgiveness. It's awesome. In your name we pray together. Amen.